The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the numero uno technology podcast from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Alex Krotowski, and this week I've been obsessed with the different ways I can watch the Olympics. I've used the vanilla television option from the BBC, and I've watched the video on the website, but as a person who doesn't have a digital TV or use a digital signal, I'm bothered by the limited access I have to the sports I actually want to watch. Joining me today to fume over the loss of hours of Olympic gold are Bobby Johnson and Jemima Kish, whom I'm sure have had much better things to do recently than curse the lack of world-class beach volleyball coverage.
Hello.
That's one way of putting it. Yeah.
Or you could say I've been stuck for a week on Lundy without even a television, let alone Olympic coverage.
Gale Force winds as well, hasn't it been?
Yeah, my passage off the island was delayed by force 7 to 8 gusting 9 storm force winds.
Wow. Bobby, have you been Olympicking?
I watched some of the opening ceremony on Friday last week. That was fantastic. and then been kind of dipping in and out. I'm kind of, as you can tell from my honed physique, I'm more into the athletics than the water sports,
as it were.
Although you know, a bit of rowing goes down. Basically, anything that a loser can win at, and Britain are pretty good losers. So
they're doing pretty well this year already. So let's not knock them. Well, we did the Olympics last week, so this little grumble is all you're going to get about the competition over the next 30 or so minutes. Instead, we're speaking with the BBC's very own Q. Andy Bauer, straight from the Media Corporation's own Laboratory of Technology Dreams, Kingswood Warren. We're also speaking with the media funny men, Adam Buxton and Joe Cornish. All this, plus the latest news, feedback from you on the blogs, and more. So much more. So stick around. We have such great sights to show you. Kingswood Warren is the BBC's equivalent of Q's Invention Lab. Based in a gothic mansion in deepest, darkest Surrey, the research and development locus of the broadcaster has brought colour TV, CFAX and Freeview, amongst others, into the world. But things haven't been going so swimmingly for the House of Invention lately, as Jemima, you went to find out.
Yes, Kingswood Warren is closing after 60 years. Some people might think that's quite sensible for a country manor, but there is a particular ethos and tradition at Kingswood Warren that's very precious, and people are worried that might be affected some way. So I started by asking Andy Bauer about some of the projects which Kingswood's engineers are working on at the moment.
The ones to do with digital TV platforms, with the advances with Freeview playback and the development of FreeSat as that becomes a more established platform. As a consumer, you will see a lot of the stuff from the virtual production side of things, certainly with the Olympics coming up, certainly the London Olympics, that will be used quite a lot. Longer term, the 3D and the ultra-high definition, that's going to take a while to get into the consumer's home, but there is the hope that for the London Olympics, again, we can use that for large displays in public areas. So should see quite a lot of it, and it won't be all of it too far off as well.
Now, quite a lot of the work you do here is very experimental. How much of an influence does this work have on the mainstream? We've obviously got some extremely clever engineers who are working here on some very clever projects, but in terms of my mum watching her TV, I mean, how much influence do they really have on the mainstream?
I would say a huge amount, because we shouldn't be doing anything that hasn't got buy-in, even if it's well over the horizon, some sort of buy-in from the business that there is a good justifiable reason to do it. Obviously, part of doing research is taking risks, so not everything will appear on air or go through to a product or a system, but a lot of it will. The way we work is really to develop open source, open standards.
So you'll be starting to move the 120 or so staff from Kingswood Warren in October this year, and they'll be moving to Salford. But the technology is more at the heart of the BBC than ever before, and the enormous success of the BBC website is evidence of that. What significance is it going to have that the technology team, the research and development team, is that much more involved with the rest of the organisation, and that you'll all be based on the same site?
Right. Well, I should just clarify that the move in October this year is the future media half of research and innovation that will ultimately is destined to go to Salford in 2010. But at first, we'll be moving to the White City West 12 area. Kingswood has been the home of research and innovation for 60 years. It's a lovely place. But the opportunities of going to work more closely with our colleagues on the operational side and to be able to get feedback from them about what their issues are, what their problems, and to be able to, more importantly, feed ideas into them and allow them to get early sight of new technologies, play with that technology, experiment with it. I can see that working much more widely across the whole range of projects that the department undertakes.
It's a very, very beautiful place, though. Are there going to be a few disgruntled staff who are perhaps sad to leave these palatial surroundings?
I think there'll be some people, myself included, will be sad to leave here, but I think the opportunities and the key thing is actually the quality of the work and the scope of the work that the staff can undertake. And nice as the grounds and the place is, that's what I think actually gets them out of bed every day to come to work and enjoy their work.
So, Jemima, how important would you say Kingswood Warren is to the BBC? If, for example, they scrapped the whole concept, the whole idea of technologies being innovated from within the house, and they just simply bought technologies from outside, what effect would that have on the output of the BBC?
I'd say that Kingswood Warren is more important than the BBC perhaps realises, or a lot of the people at the BBC, which is very dominated by the kind of glamour of the TV world. But none of that would be possible if it wasn't for the technology that goes on here. And the work that these guys do, and girls, I should say, is so long-term, it's almost intangible in some places. Some of the things they're working on at the moment are kind of navigation tools for audio, which recognise different bands of sound and can kind of visualise a whole programme so you can navigate all the way through. Then there's compression systems for TV because they're moving away from things being recorded on tape, and that's going to save the BBC millions. There are so many projects they work on, and they have a time scale where they're often looking 10, sometimes 20 years in the future. And there are people there with a real ethos of public service. They don't have a commercial mindset. And they're just completely dedicated to the BBC, and we just don't hear about the work that they do enough.
As licence fee payers, effectively as the people who pay their salaries, I'd like to know more about these types of things. But at the same time, I also recognise that we pay a lot for the content. So as taxpayers, how can we really, or not taxpayers, but ultimately as licence fee payers, how can we validate, and also how can we celebrate this?
A lot of the problems in this part of the BBC, problems as perceived by the staff, is because the BBC sold off its technology wing with exactly the rationale which you just have, which was shouldn't they be concentrating on the content and outsourcing the technology. But as a member of staff pointed out to me, Siemens' objective was ultimately to make money for Siemens. And there is a different set of motivations that the people at Kingswood Warren have because they're working for public service, and a lot of things they do will have a benefit for licence fee payers and might not be projects that Siemens would even touch because they only do what is on their to-do list.
Who is Siemens within this context?
Sorry, yes. BBC Technology was sold to Siemens in 2004.
You know, we might say, oh, God, shouldn't the BBC just do the media bit? And, you know, well, shouldn't Google just do the technology bit? Shouldn't Microsoft just do the technology bit?
One of the interesting things that I found from both the article that you wrote in The Guardian this week and also what we heard from Andy Bauer before is this idea of this open source concept. So is it actually open source in the sense that anybody could take this technology and adapt it and turn it into something for their own media consumption or their own media broadcast?
No. Well, some of the projects they work on, they're developing in an open way, but they are licensing. So they're actually returning money to the BBC that way, which is a very important point to add, I think.
You know, what it comes down to is what are these guys good at? And if you sell off or you parcel off bits of your business to concentrate on what you think is the valuable part, then you may not find out for 10, 20, 30 years what the problem was. I mean, I think Greg Dyke, the former BBC Director General, got away massively at the time with selling off BBC technology. And it's the same reason that closing Kingswood Warren is money, basically, is saying, OK, let's sell it off, let's run it out of White City or run it out of Salford as it will be. I think, you know, you have to look at it and say, somewhere down the line, are you going to regret doing this? And maybe they will.
A key part of why they're saying they're doing it, though, is because they want the research team to work more closely with the rest of the organisation. But there is an issue here that perhaps the autonomy of Kingswood Warren has actually been a benefit, because they're not influenced by a lot of the politics and the bureaucracy of the BBC in the tele department or the radio department or whatever. They just go ahead and pursue things that they know are technologically powerful, and there might not be an obvious application for those immediately.
One of the things that we're really talking about here, though, is this idea of people overlooking the value of research and development within the BBC. And I'm wondering if there are any areas where you would say research and development is actually celebrated. Are there any companies who are particularly notable for their research and development?
Big companies spend a lot of money on R&D. You get to be big by being ahead of the curve, and you only get ahead of the curve by either buying your way, which very rarely works, or actually learning things along the way. Nobody would have a problem with Google having a big facility somewhere. Nobody has a problem with IBM having somewhere like Hursley Park, which is quite similar to Kingswood Warren in a lot of ways. What it ultimately comes down to is, you know, license fee payers' money, and do you see an immediate payoff or a very long-term payoff? And the BBC have got to be better at arguing for the long term, which is, I think, what they've failed to do. I've got big issues with the BBC Trust, with the direction that people have taken the BBC and the short-termism. And, you know, there are some good people there, and but they have a long-term vision. And unless you kind of really work hard to say, this will pay off in 5, 10, 15 years, then you're screwed, because everyone goes, sorry, I'm spending 120 quid a year on this.
Mm. Jemima, any last thoughts
and
on that?
Yeah, just that a lot of the Kingswood Warren issue has been preoccupied with, you know, this country manor. And actually that misses the point completely, because the power of Kingswood Warren is in its data infrastructure and in the ethos that it's built up. So it's not about, you know, this beautiful estate, because it's actually quite shabby. It's about how you can retain the power and the influence of an incredibly important research establishment, and whether it's being given the respect that it's due.
Well, thank you very much, Jemima, and thanks. Many thanks to Andy Bauer. You can read more about the move in The Guardian and check out a movie, actually, of their next innovation.
A movie.
A moving picture with voices.
Cinema video of their next innovations on guardian.co.uk. But now, for more education, information and, dare I say it, entertainment, here's Jemima with the news.
Security experts at last week's Black Hat conference demonstrated how Vista's security measures have become useless following a fresh wave of attacks that exploit a weakness in Internet Explorer. Microsoft pledged a new host of patches on August the 12th in response. eBay took a decided step towards mainstream retail by allowing retailers to list thousands of items at fixed prices. Furious users say the site is moving away from its roots as a tool for collectors as it strikes retail deals with Littlewoods, Argos and Orange. Apple's chief executive Steve Jobs said 60 million applications have been sold through the iTunes store in 30 days. Sales have generated $1 million per day, with 70% going to developers. The University of Twente in the Netherlands has developed a paving stone that cleans the air, converting nitrogen from car exhaust into a harmless nitrate that will wash away. The material will be used for a trial road paving project by the end of the year.
So, Bobby, can you tell me a bit about this Vista Security? It has to do very much with a security problem in applications on the web.
Last week at the Black Hat conference, where all of the world's hackers get together and share these kind of security problems with each other, some researchers from IBM and VMware got up and they said, Vista's got its security stuff in place, but you know what? If you use a browser, you can get around it. And so they showed a number of ways using .NET, using Java and ActiveX to kind of basically bypass everything, all the good stuff that was in Vista, to protect users. Bit of a big deal, really.
And is it just browsers that are based on Internet Explorer, or is it any of the other browsers that are available?
What they're saying is they have demonstrated it here in a fully Microsoft environment, but they believe the exploits actually have a wider application than that and can go cross-platform, cross-browser. Just depends how you use them.
And this wasn't the only security breach that happened this week, is it?
Well, there's been there's been a lot of security stuff in the news in the last week or so, because we've had Black Hat and we've also had DEF CON which is happening at the moment, two big kind of security hacker conferences. And so one of the other interesting ones that's come out of this was the story of three kids from MIT who came up with a way to hack Boston's underground system. It's called the Charlie card, is your kind of the equivalent of an Oyster card. And they found out, you know, you can hack into that system. But they were publicizing the talk they were going to give at DEF CON, and the Boston Transport Authority found out about it and said, hang on a second, we don't like the look of this. And so they basically got an injunction out to stop these researchers talking about it. So that's quite interesting. I mean, you know, there are normally ways you talk about security flaws that allow people time to fix it, but you don't normally get people suing to stop you talking about the security flaw, which is what's happened here. And not only have they sued the three guys who did it, they've also sued MIT itself, saying that they should have taught them better, basically. So this one might roll on a bit.
Jemima, coming over to the Apple stuff, that's very interesting. That's quite a lot of apps
that's
that were downloaded.
That's a hell of a lot of apps, isn't it?
What did we think? It was something like six apps per new iPhone.
Well, Bobby, doing some sort of napkin-style arithmetic, has calculated it's about six apps per person if 10 million iPhones have been sold. Steve Jobs told the Wall Street Journal that he thought they would make $360 million. That is, from the App Store. But then he said, well, that could easily go over $500 million in a year, which, of course, I'm sure the shareholders love. But I think the really interesting thing here is that arguably the most innovative and certainly the most attention that Facebook has had was for its application developer platform. But they haven't really made any money through that. It was a brilliant idea and got lots of interest in applications and what the potential was. Apple have really got, you know, they've used their perfect walled garden to get some serious money in there. They do only get 30% of the sales of apps, but it's really interesting that they've managed to take the kind of application phenomena and really, you know, put some big money in it.
You can read more about these stories, plus the latest up-to-the-minute findings and headlines on guardian.co.uk/technology. They burst onto the scene in 1995, bringing a generation of Channel 4 viewers the first example of user-generated content on television. Adam Buxton and Joe Cornish, collectively known as Adam and Joe, have continued to innovate using a whole host of technologies at their disposals. Here's a clip from their award-winning podcast, taken from their Saturday morning show on 6 Music. Here we
go. The St. Winifred School Choir there.
They've just broken
breaking
in.
It up.
We're trying to get rid of them, but they bust into the mobile studio that we've got here at Summer Sunday in Leicester. And three of them, I kicked a couple of them.
Are you talking about the St. Winifred School Choir?
Yeah, I kicked Winifred in the shins and pushed
Saint
her.
St. Winifred. You kicked a saint in
it's
the
It's not
what?
An actual saint, no.
Bobby, you lucky bastard. You spoke with them about their love affair with user-generated content. What happened?
Yeah, well, a few weeks back, we did a web chat. Do you remember those?
I remember.
With Adam and Joe on the Guardian website. And I went down to Adam's recording studio in the back of his garden somewhere in South London. But I was really interested to talk to them because, you know, I remember seeing them kind of appear on the scene. And they kind of presaged YouTube in a way. They kind of did this DIY TV, and they've made a career out of it. And so, you know, so I thought, okay, here's a good chance to ask them, you know, what they think about the situation, how they feel about the kind of democratization of media that in a way they stand for. So first of all, I grabbed them and said, do you feel an affinity for YouTubers, and do you feel like you're some kind of guiding light to them?
Well, I wouldn't say we were a guiding light for them, but we definitely feel an affinity. We started we started on telly in like about 1995, four or five, on a show called Takeover TV. And we were using basically the first generation of affordable video cameras. And then we used to often edit in camera, and we would do like songs and stuff on a little 8-track. So I think there's always been, you know, the technology for people to do lo-fi stuff, but it's certainly, the problem used to be to get it seen, didn't it? You used to just do it and take it around to friends' houses and... But there really was no potential ever to get it on telly or to be seen by anybody else. And that's what the internet's really changed, I suppose, that, you know, you can get it seen by a million people at no cost, kind of instantaneously, rather than have to submit it to programs like Takeover TV, which was a very, you know, rare program even back then, kind of thing.
And, of course, there's no agenda on YouTube or any other place where you want to post clips on the internet. and there always will be on TV. Certainly when we started, the show that we contributed to, Takeover TV, was a kind of a public access thing, and half of it was treating the public as if, you know, all the public were good for in those days, if they were going to contribute their own material to TV, was for doing kind of vox pops and stuff, you know? You'd have like an old man doing a video diary about how the council weren't clearing away his rubbish. And really there was very little of people actually just fooling around and making their own entertainment themselves on TV.
People were kind of considered as nutty, weren't they? Yeah. Takeover TV was like, look at these nutty idiots, like with their eccentric tastes and behavior and stuff. And it took like a couple of series for the producers to realize there was actually genuinely, sincerely funny stuff that you could laugh with rather than at.
Exactly. But even then, it was considered quite marginal. You know, we were never commissioned by the entertainment department at Channel 4. At least we weren't to begin with. We came out of the religion and features department. You know, we weren't really considered in any way mainstream entertainment. We were just like a little weirdo corner of Channel 4. And that was a nice place to be, really.
Yeah, the most innovative program used to be You've Been Framed, didn't it? Or the program that used user-generated content most was You've Been Framed, which is just grannies, bloomers, and people falling over and stuff. And actually, I don't think TV's attitude to user-generated content has changed a lot at all since then. I still think they mainly think it's a kind of adjunct to programmes like that BBC Three show, The Wall, where they regard it as a kind of a segment. Let's have a segment where people send in their clips.
That's right. If anything, the sort of compressed, crappy visual look of YouTube clips has kind of further compartmentalised that kind of user-generated content on TV. It's like it denotes the fact this isn't really proper TV. It's made by a normal bloke outside of the whole commissioning process and the TV corporations, you know what I mean? So it's great in some ways that people have an outlet for their stuff on YouTube, and it does get a lot more views, a lot of this stuff, than anything on BBC Three or any of these kind of little terrestrial or cable channels. But as far as TV's concerned, it's probably a little bit threatened by that stuff. So it's probably in their interest to keep it looking quite otherworldly.
But you've also kind of grabbed a lot of other digital media stuff as well. I mean, the podcast you put out, not only do you do an official BBC podcast, but you've also done a secondary podcast to that as well. And your songs go up on iTunes. You've got an album out at the moment. Do you feel like you're at the forefront of grabbing the media that works for you, or do you think that you're just, this is what people do these days?
It's not premeditated how we've sort of put stuff out. It's really just, you know, a result of desperation. We've always kind of been drawn to places that let us do exactly what we want, basically. And we were really lucky with the Adam and Joe TV show in that we got a commissioner who basically gave us almost kind of final cut on it and let us put whatever we wanted. We found that very difficult to get since the show was so kindly cancelled by Channel 4. Thanks a lot, guys. We found it difficult to find other outlets that let us do exactly what we want. And radio was one, XFM and now the BBC. And podcasts are another, where you basically don't have any editorial outside influence. You can just cut it and you know, let it be what you want it to be.
Plus, the other thing is that when Joe and I get together and do stuff, often we're reacting to what's around us in the pop cultural world, and it's nice to be able to hijack some of those things or screw around with clips or whatever, or reference things that maybe would be a problem on TV. You know, even when we were doing the Adam and Joe show, we had a lot of trouble clearing things, and since we did that, I mean, that was 10 years ago now, it's impossible. But YouTube, I mean, obviously you're not supposed to upload copyrighted material and screw around with it, but it's sort of taken as read that it happens and it's doable. It's really nice to have that freedom.
So user-generated content, it is like the biggest thing, right? Everybody and their uncle is trying to get user-generated content and community and this and that and the other into their media enterprises, whether it's government, whether it's big business, whether it's TV. What will be lost when user-generated content is actually co-opted and brought into these spaces, Bobby?
Has it not already happened?
Well, has been lost then?
Well, I think it's a tough one because I suppose Adam and Joe symbolise it in a way. You know, they submitted some videos to a TV show. The TV show thought they were good. They got a job out of it. Now they've kind of built a brand and they
they do okay.
They're not
very
complaining.
Much.
Yeah.
The problem is that you either end up with this compartmentalized approach where it's just stuff that happens out in the world and we suck it in, or you end up with the opposite happening and it being stifled too early. And so I suppose the problem is basically the problem with trying to grow anything. You have to find that delicate balance and say, okay, here are the people we nurture and we give things to, and here are the people we don't. Unfortunately, user-generated content, which I find a slightly offensive term anyway, that's been used by a lot of faceless, soulless corporate organizations to mean some kind of interaction which we can get on the cheap from our users. That's what's got to stop, is, you know, this isn't a free ride. This is about promoting good stuff.
But what actually is there on mainstream TV that we'd class as user content?
Well, on BBC Three, for example, they've got The Wall, which is idents that people have sent in the same way that, you know, Takeover TV used to be. On television ads, we see that a lot. For example, Electronic Arts used Machinima that was created by people who play The Sims to advertise The Sims. So we are starting to see that again
and
again.
That's quite token usage, though. And, you know, there's snippets on the news, and citizen journalism is a whole other thing than Not for the Tech podcast, I think. But is there any meaningful platform where people are really encouraged to be really creative and given longer form content?
One example would be Current TV, one of Al Gore's little brain children that's out there, you know, and that's exactly what they do. Here you go, you've got 5 minutes to do a report. It's a bit citizen journalism-y. But still, that's problematic. Nobody watches it in this country. But, I mean, basically, the problem is that it's still not the norm. You know, it's not that people are submitting videos because they're good. It's almost because they're submitting them and they're kind of bad.
Doesn't user content work best then when it stays within the realm of the internet? It's when it's co-opted by the mainstream media that it all starts to go a bit wrong and tokenistic.
I was going to ask actually that very question, Maima, because it seems still that television is the holy grail. If people, you know, people want to be noticed, they want to then have an Adam and Joe moment where suddenly they're thrust into the limelight. So they're not actually making it for the sake of the technologies and to say, look, this is fantastic, let's make this its own channel. They're using it in order to propel them into something that's more mainstream.
Well, a lot of it obviously is successful within the terms of the long tail, and that doesn't work on television. I mean, if you look at YouTube, there are some phenomenally successful YouTube stars who wouldn't register on, I don't know, maybe even The Wall or something. You know, they wouldn't register on a Channel 4 sort of late night slot. Some of those programs in the late night slots on, you know, the main channels only get sort of a couple of 100,000 viewers.
It all comes down to money, basically. There's still money in TV. There's still a lot of money in TV. And, you know, despite the fact that the internet advertising market has grown a lot, we're probably hitting an ad recession, but we're also seeing most of that being taken by Google. So I think what it comes down to is there is still money, there is still prestige, there is still value out there. And what, say, Salon, what they're trying to do is say, are there ways which we can push small amounts of money to the creators? That's what YouTube are trying to do when they let people sign up and have ads on their videos. I think in the long term, we have to think not about big media, but about small media. I don't think there are going to be that many big media companies out there. But what you can do is try and be fruitful within a small community. You look at Facebook, that's entirely user-generated content, and they do very nicely, thank you very much, just by creating this economy inside Facebook. So I think you have to look at those models and say, in the long term, it has to not be about being on TV. How do we get there? And I think mostly that's not a technological shift. I think mostly that's just a mind shift.
Well, you can hear Adam and Joe on their Six Music radio show every Saturday morning from 9 to 12, or on the podcast, or on their many other podcasts and blogs and YouTube, this and that, and the others channels that they have. But now I think we've talked about ourselves long enough. Let's hear what you have to say about what's been going on in the world of technology. Bobby, what's been the buzz in the technology blog over the past week?
Oh, there's been so much going on. There's loads. But I'm actually going to focus in on a bit of... this is like instant feedback. We heard earlier about Kingswood Warren. This was from someone called Gargano on Twitter, who said they think that closing Kingswood Warren is a sin, or at least a crime. Who could possibly be proud of that decision?
Is that 140 characters?
that might even be less.
Wow.
Or
impressive.
Fewer, sorry.
Well, over on the games blog, we also have had a very busy time of it. There was plenty of things going on, but I thought I'd pick up on Cool Pete's comments from Greg's post on the gimmicky nature of Nintendo's fitness product, the Wii Fit. He says, it's not going to put people off gaming, but I think people could just buy it just for Wii Fit, get bored and put everything, machine and all, into a cupboard, never to be removed again. He says, people aren't buying Wii Fit to play games. They see it as a shortcut to fitness, like the other gadgets, which is why it's faddish. It makes Nintendo money, but he doesn't see it as a gateway drug into gaming as a whole. He says, I'd be surprised if 5% of the people who buy Wii Fit play something gamey like Zelda or Metroid. And that is a massive, massive problem, according to the people on the games blog.
Gateway drug.
They want...
I need some gateway drugs.
I want some Wii crack. Jemima, what's been going on? What crack has been going on in the PDA?
Well, while I was on Lundy, we had the first few posts from Paid Content, which is now our sister site. So this was a post by Robert Andrews about number 10 Downing Street, introducing a new video site called Number 10 TV in a new effort to help Gordon Brown engage with the public. We know where this is going, don't we?
And it was just,
just a very short comment from Essex, who said, why don't they just screen old episodes of Yes, Prime Minister and let us work how they've screwed things up?
I actually preferred Yes, Minister, if we're going to go there. The ascent to power is always more interesting.
The political views of anybody in this studio are not the political views of The Guardian as a whole.
Oh, but sack them all. Sack them all.
Thank you, Bobby.
And we can run a feature about his terrible choice of shoes.
And restraining order forthcoming. But you can contribute to these conversations on blogs.guardian.co.uk/games/technology/digital-content. But please do let us know what you're getting up to. And importantly, where online you've been getting your live Olympic beach and indoor volleyball streams. Because, yes, well, I did say I wouldn't mention the games again.
You liar.
I'm so annoyed that I can't watch these games. This is my sport, people. Anyway, answers on a postcard to tech@guardian.co.uk. That's it for this week. Many thanks to our guests, Andy Bauer and Adam and Joe. Cheers, of course, to our superior pod team, Jemima, Bobby, and producer Scott, who's in the glass box. We're back next week with even more technological goodies. Until then, I'm Alex Kratosky. I may be somebody different after that. Oh, it's my favorite joke. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.